This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Universities no longer bat an eye when academics ask to pay scholarly attention to popular culture in the classroom. Facebook friendships and even the cast of Jersey Shore have gotten the ivory tower treatment in recent years. Popular culture's place in the academy may no longer be controversial, but that's only because of professors like Mark Anthony Neal. Mark began writing about social and political issues in the context of African-American music back in the 1990s. As a teacher, he found new ways to connect with students using songs, films, and books as lenses to examine contemporary life. And his concentration on entertainment trends of mainstream black culture made him a pioneer in the field of African-American studies. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of black popular culture in the Department of African and African-American Studies at Duke. He's written five books, including the most recent New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity. And he's the host of a web series called Left of Black, which is produced at Duke. He's been a good friend of the show, and I'm happy to welcome Mark Anthony Neal back to the State of Things. Hi, Mark.
What's up, Frank? How you doing?
I'm doing fine. All the better for having you here. The field of pop culture studies, as we said, it kind of emerged slowly and has met with resistance from university traditionalists and the orthodox. How is the field defined today? How would you define it?
You know, I think it's all over the place. Monthia Diawara, who's a great film scholar, African film scholar from New York University, you know, he talked about the fact that popular culture is where black folks theorize about blackness. And I think folks have always intuitively understood this. I mean, when you read Langston Hughes, I mean, Langston Hughes understood that. Amiri Baraka understood that. There have always been writers and critics who've understood the power of looking at popular music and popular culture as a way to explore the broader implications of black life. But it really is in the late 1980s with the, you know, advent of cultural studies, American cultural studies, and folks like Juanima Lubiano, my, you know, colleague at Duke University, and a few other folks, you know, writing about popular culture and very, you know, significant and theoretical ways that folks begin to kind of wrap their heads around the trends.
Has the controversy died down?
I think it has. I mean, there's still, you know, an old guard and old holdouts, you know, that ultimately I think are very derisive of popular culture in the sense of who consumes it. You know, if you think about the academy largely being a space where scholars are always in communication with each other, they write for each other, they review for each other, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think there is still a kind of side eye that's given the scholars who see their audience as broader than the academy.
Is it just the audience? I mean, the other complaint, I guess, or critique is that it is precisely the role of the scholar to look at things over time and to give it the time that it needs. And then when you're doing it while it's still hot, you know, the scholarship may not be as...
And that exactly is the challenge of doing, you know, scholarship and popular culture, right? You know, and I very often describe my work as an interventionist work. To bring a critical lens to complicate the discourse around popular culture, literally as it's coming off the production line, right? And that's just a different mind, you know, mindset, you know, than scholars who spend an incredible amount of time in archives and, you know, historians sometimes will spend 10 years, you know, writing their work because it's very detailed oriented. And that's not to mean that folks who do popular culture aren't interested in archives, but it's just a different set of archives. You know, my archives are digital, right?
Well, and it doesn't mean that the scholarship can't change over time. But that
exactly.
Giving it a point of view and thinking about it in an intellectual way, even if it's just hot off the presses, is a good thing
to do.
It's
a good thing,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Did scholars of black popular culture studies, do you think, like yourself, have an even tougher time because it was black studies?
I think that was part of it, right? You know, if you think about black studies as already being ghettoized and undervalued within the academy, you know, the idea that there'd be someone spending any amount of time talking about hip-hop, you know, just further devalues that. And I think there are some tensions within mainstream African-American studies that sometimes the most visible scholars within African-American studies are those folks who are talking about popular culture and hip-hop.
Your first book, What the Music Said, Black Popular Music and Black Popular Culture, was published in 1998. And that book has it's continued, really, to receive high praise for being an early examination of rap and hip-hop as a critique of black culture. What was the message of that book?
You know, I was a big fan in grad school of David Halberstam. His social histories, you know, 1964. I mean, I just love that kind of work. And I wanted to do something along those lines around the history of black music in the post-World War II period and its relationship to civil rights and black power movement. At the same time, you know, I also came through the Academy grad school at a time where, you know, this incredible theoretical work was also very important to me. So my first book is kind of a blending of this kind of social and cultural history, you know, with this kind of theoretical stuff. And I love doing that work because it allowed me actually to put my own personal life into some sort of context. You know, my father, you know, who dropped out of school when he was 10 years old, you know, he was a functional illiterate. But Sunday mornings, he would sit there and play all this rich, you know, gospel music and jazz music and blues. And I would just sit there and watch him even more so than listen to the music. And when I worked on my first book, which came out of my dissertation at the University of Buffalo, it allowed me actually to go back and think about being in those spaces with my dad and the music that he listened to. And as someone who was a migrant from the Deep South, you know, who moved from Augusta, Georgia to New York in 1959, you know, what was it that he traveled with him music? Right, and that's what his Sunday mornings were about.
You might be listening to music like this. Jimmy McGriff, the Bird Waves, some of the music you might have grown up listening to.
Yeah, Hammond B3s, gospel quartets, yeah. And Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King. I mean, that was, he didn't have a wide range of taste in music, but he had about seven or eight groups at the Mighty Clouds of Joy, Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, you know, Jimmy McGriff, Jimmy Smith, and Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King. I mean, that was where he was.
You talked about the fact that he came from Georgia. He was part of that migration. You realize now that he's taking something with him. And, of course, he's now in a new context. He's in New York City. All of those intellectual concepts around this music that was your Sunday afternoon. When did those ideas start creeping into your head?
You know, it actually started when I was in college. And as part of missing being at home, a kind of homesickness, you know, when I went to State University of New York at Fredonia, you know, up in western New York. It's about 8 hours away from New York City. First generation kid in terms of college. And so whenever I would go home, I would make these cassette tapes. And I started making cassette tapes of his music. And part of it was like, you know, those Sunday mornings in college, I wanted to be back in that living room with my, you know, with my mother and my dad. And so that's when I began to seriously start thinking about. But it really wasn't until graduate school when I'm reading all these great books about the Great Migration, about black culture in general in a scholarly context. And I realized that some of the stories that I was reading, you know, were the stories of my parents, were the stories of my father. When I later got to talk after his death with some of my uncles about my dad, and they talked about when he first moved to New York City in 1959, the only thing he had was a transistor radio, right? And that transistor radio was with him all the time. And that was his way to bring the South with him, you know, when he was up in New York to help him navigate that space.
I want to talk more about your thoughts about this music. But before we do that, I want to get a little better insight and picture of your family life. You did talk about your father. Tell us about your mother. Did she work?
She was, you know, my parents were working class. They both are now deceased. But, you know, my mom grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. My grandmother actually was a domestic for Davy Johnson, you know, who was then playing for, you know, the Baltimore Orioles. Deeply religious family and probably too religious for my mom, you know. So she literally left Baltimore and moved to New York as a 17-year-old, again in the late 1950s. And that's where she met my dad. You know, so they were working class folks. They weren't educated in the traditional sense. She stayed home until it was time for me to go to school, and she became a school lunch worker. And by the time that she died, she was a high school teacher. So she put an incredible amount of value into education. And in fact, a year before I started college, she started college herself. We graduated about a week apart from each other in 1987.
And education was important, as you said, so much so they didn't want you going to public schools in New York back then.
No, my mother was very fearful of even the violence of public schools in New York City, you know, in the early 1970s. So she sent me to the only black 7-day Adventist school in the Bronx.
You
know, right next to the Jackson Projects, R.T. Hudson, which is where Jimmy Walker of Good Times grew up. And I spent 8 years there with six wonderful African-American teachers, all women. And what I always think about now in terms of that experience is that, you know, my own intellectual development from the very beginning was always tied to my relationship with black women as thinkers and scholars, et cetera.
Were you a good student?
I was a very good student in elementary school, you know, if not a little lazy.
You watched a lot of TV as a kid, which is not unusual, except that you were watching all kinds of TV. And what were you picking up from the news back then?
One of the things I picked up from the news was how to talk. you know, that there was clearly a way that folks talked for a mainstream audience that was important for you to navigate the world.
When did you first realize that there was
something
about
the way you were talking?
You know,
I don't think I thought about it
consciously.
I just felt this concern. And part of it, you know, was my parents, right? Coming from the Deep South, you know, very colorful use of the English language. And so I intuitively understood that if I was going to be successful beyond the little sphere, you know, of the South Bronx, that I had to talk a certain kind of way that would make me comfortable, right? And make other folks comfortable with my presence. I remember one time going to see the film Rocky, Rocky II, in fact, and my father and I are in a taxi cab. We're going to a theater on Valentine Avenue in the Bronx over in the Fordham section. And as I'm giving the cab driver directions, he turns and looks at my father and I, and he goes, "You're not from around here, are you?" Right. And that was just his response. And so growing up, I often dealt with a lot of my peers, you know, accusing me of acting white or sounding white. For me, I think I intuitively understood that it was a way that I had to navigate the world. And ironically, it's something that I've passed on, I think, definitely to my oldest daughter, you know, who has that same kind of skill and talent.
We will talk more about that as our conversation with Mark Anthony Neal continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour is Professor Mark Anthony Neal, who teaches black popular culture in Duke's Department of African and African-American Studies. You talked about growing up in the Bronx, literally at the time hip-hop was born.
Yeah.
So there were many Africa Bambaataa sightings, I suppose.
I grew up in Federal Housing Projects known as Throgs Neck. We sat right between the Throgs Neck Bridge and the Whitestone Bridge. We were a black and Latino enclave around what is largely an Italian neighborhood. So, you know, we were stuck in the projects. But we were also literally across the Bronx River from the Bronx River Houses. And this is where some of the incredible activity that was happening with hip hop, notably African Bambaataa, Zulu Nation, you know, so kids that I played sandlot baseball with, you know, were members of Zulu Nation, were, you know, I remember Ike C in particular, you know, is one of the cats who became big, you know, from the neighborhood. So it was all around and it wasn't unusual. I mean, literally, I could look out from my apartment and look into the park, and they were having jams there as early as 1977 and 1978. And ironically, I had no interest in it, you know, at the time. I'm sitting in my room playing Stratomatic baseball and listening to Top 40 on WABC and WNBC and folks like that and Little River Band and, you know.
Wow. All kind of rock music, really.
Yeah, you know, album-oriented rock, right. Middle-of-the-road stuff. I mean, that was the stuff that I was listening to growing up. And literally, this revolution is occurring outside the door that I have no real interest in at the time.
When did you become interested?
It actually was when I went to college. Let me be even more specific. Let me just say Run-DMC. You know, the first time I heard Run-DMC was returning from my prom. It's like 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, 1983, and Sucker MC comes on. And I'd never heard anything like that before. And so that was the thing that really kind of unlocked me. And Run-DMC kind of presented an aesthetic, both in terms of their style and dress and all those things that I found incredibly interesting. So I begin my immersion in hip-hop probably, you know, about 1983.
When you heard it on the radio, did you say to yourself, hey, but that's the stuff that was going on outside my window?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I can remember when we first heard Rapper's Delight in 1979 and literally us kind of running around as like 13-year-old, 12-year-old kids going, you know, did you hear that on the radio? Right? Because in our mind, it was never anything that was going to transition from being this kind of street culture into being something that we would hear on the radio. And clearly we never envisioned it to be the billion-dollar industry and global, you know, culture that it's become now.
You talked about going to the Seventh-day Adventist school in the Bronx. then you went to Brooklyn Tech for high school, which is kind of a long train ride for you.
Yeah, it was, you know, interesting choice by my parents. I often joke with my daughter, you know, my oldest daughter, because, you know, we won't let them go outside in the cul-de-sac, you know, without, you know. And growing up in New York City, I mean, we literally would travel all throughout the five boroughs in public transportation. And our parents never thought anything about it, you know. So I'm taking a bus and two trains to school every day. 2 hours there, 2 hours back. You know, I got a lot of reading done. At Brooklyn Tech, we were required to have a subscription to the New York Times. And it came with this wonderful little pocket New York Times dictionary that I still have. And as part of that process, they taught us how to fold the New York Times in the right way so that we could read it on. And to this day, I still fold it. So I have it in a nice little compact way. And so it was a great experience for me. And one of the things I also did, I started to keep collections of steno pads. So I begin to write on these pads while I'm traveling back and forth. At the time, it was poetry and some other stuff. But, you know, it was a great experience for me because it took me well beyond the Bronx. It gave me a kind of broader view of what New York City was. This was Fort Greene, you know, right before Spike Lee, you know, was going to make the area very, you know, popular. In fact, Spike Lee's joint, the store, was on the next corner, you know, from my high school after I graduated. So it was a great experience. And my father worked in Brooklyn, right? He was a short order cook in Crown Heights. He worked at a Jewish combination deli and drugstore in Crown Heights. You know, so I think my parents were comfortable with me traveling to Brooklyn because if anything happened, my dad wasn't too far away.
So you did that, but now you had to have a major at Brooklyn Tech, right? And it was not cultural studies.
It was not cultural studies. I mean, Brooklyn Tech was it's an incredible school. I mean, there were 6,000 students. Yeah, well. The auditorium, which holds 2,000, is the largest auditorium in New York City other than Radio City Music Hall. It had 8 floors. It had a working foundry. So we were required to take classes in foundry. So, you know, I had to choose a major. And I wanted to do communications because I had this kind of sense of media at the time. But my parents were like, no, if you're going to this engineering school, you're going to be an engineer. You know, so I majored in mechanical engineering.
How'd that go?
Not very well. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of my teachers understood that I didn't really have an interest in it.
You then went to, you talked about going to SUNY, State University of New York at Fredonia. Little town kind of along the, not far from Lake Erie there, but not Brooklyn or the Bronx.
It's a different kind of, eight and a half hours from New York City. Didn't visit the place before I went. You know, I'm first generation, you know, going to school. And the only reason why I decided to go to Fredonia, I had got accepted at Pratt Institute, which is engineering school in Brooklyn. Very different trajectory in my life, I think, if I would have made that choice. Right. But I had a neighbor who had an older sister who had gone for Fredonia in the early 1970s and had a great experience. And she was the one who talked me into making this trip. And you know, I'm thankful that I did because it really put me going forward in terms of, you know, what my future life would be. I became politicized there. I began to think about things like public speaking and leadership and student activism. You know, the crux of who I've become as a scholar, as a thinker, as an activist, as a parent, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all that foundation was laid, you know, during the time I spent in SUNY Fredonia.
I mean, interesting that it would be there that you would be politicized. This is a part of the country I go visit every summer for my vacation, well aware of it. Not a lot of black folks up there.
When I started at Fredonia, there were 5,000 students there, and about 83 of them were African American. Yep. Really different. But it forced us, you know, to work very closely to think about how you leverage political influence in that context, you know, to the point that at some point, you know, the majority of students on the student association there were African American because we understood the value of being involved, you know, learned how to use Robert's Rules of Order effectively, which is why, you know, when I see it portrayed in a show like The Wire, you know, 30 years later, I'm so fascinated with that because, you know, this is one of the ways that the world moves. That and you have to learn these rules in order to be able to move things within that context.
It's interesting because it seems like you're always putting that together. What are the rules? How do we navigate? First, how do they speak?
Exactly.
Secondly,
exactly.
What are the rules of, of organization and how do we get into positions of power? Also, you met a guy named at the time named Donald Smith.
Donald Smith, Donald Muhammad, Minister Abdul Halim Muhammad these days, who's the head of the Nation of Islam. In Buffalo now, he was my first intellectual mentor. And, you know, besides the kind of Islam piece and the Nation of Islam piece, which, you know, ultimately I chose not to be interested in. I like bacon. Let me just say that. But one of the things he did for me was to introduce me to book culture. You know, so he introduces me to Hakeem Abudi's book. This is the first book he gave me, Enemies of Class of Races, which was published in Third World Press, you know, Hakeem Abudi's Independent Press. And I'm reading through this book. And one of the great gifts of this book is this kind of annotated bibliography that's in the back. And so I read his book and then read all the books that he suggested I reading. And so, you know, I was not a great undergraduate student. In fact, I was a pretty bad undergraduate student. But that wasn't because I didn't have an intellectual curiosity, right? I was reading as much outside of what was demanded of me in the classroom, you know, than I was actually, you know, reading in terms of classroom stuff.
So there are all these great books. And then he puts a question to you that probably sounds like it might have turned your life around.
This first time, you know, because I'm sitting down talking to this guy, and it's like, you know, the fall of 1983 and, you know, all this kind of stuff going on about Louis Farrakhan and all these kinds of folks. And I'm like, you know, these guys are radicals. I don't want to have anything to do with them. And he just asks, you know, this simple question, you know, what if white folks decided to no longer provide services for black folks? What would black folks do? And that just kind of changed my view of the world. You know, how to, when you talk about, you know, black nationalism ultimately is about things like self-determination. And so what does that mean, you know, economically? What does that mean culturally? And I think my own sense throughout my career around the importance of independent media, you know, whether it's in terms of writing or something like Left of Black, really comes from that foundation that if you have a story to tell, you know, you have to be able to tell that story yourself.
Media and in other areas as well, that makes you think about ownership. Who owns this stuff?
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's all great as long as we let everybody play. But as you suggest, the rules are written by the people who know the rules and who are in power. So you do that. After college now, you worked for a computer company.
Yes. So computer software.
So you're still not into cultural studies.
Still not into cultural studies. I call those years 1987 to 1991 the lost years, though I did meet my future bride or reconnect with my future bride, you know, during those days. But even then, I'm reading The Village Voice and I'm reading folks like Greg Tate and Nelson George and Harry Allen and Lisa Jones. I'm reading my first BFF, you know, Joan Morgan, who I grew up with in the Bronx. We met when we were 3 years old. I'm reading her in The Village Voice. I'm reading Nelson George's The Death of Rhythm and Blues. And so even as I'm trying to do the kind of money grab,
right,
you know, as I'm trying to pay bills and all that kind of stuff, in the back of my head, I'm like, you know, I want to do this other thing.
You know, it's interesting. We're taking you back to Fredonia, that you said the early 1980s. And this is the time of the great backlash, right? The country is really moving in a radically new direction in the Reagan years. I mean, thinking about coming of age intellectually then, where the prospect of, again, who owns this thing in the great backlash must have been even more heady for you. I mean, in terms of you're looking at your role in the future in those days, how did you see yourself in the future given what it looked like in 1983?
You know, the funniest thing is that I think many of us were incredibly excited. You know, one of the things that got us really, you know, excited was Jesse Jackson's first run for the presidency in 1984. And what was even more compelling about that is that when, you know, he and Louis Farrakhan created this alliance, you know, for my generation, it's the alliance between King and Malcolm X, you know, a generation later, you know, and of course they couldn't hold it together. You know, Jesse's trying to do one thing and Farrakhan has another agenda. But I think for us, you know, this is, you know, I'm 19 years old in 1984 when I registered to vote for the first time. So I can remember voting in that New York State primary for the first time casting a vote. And it was an incredible excitement. And then hip hop, you know, becomes the soundtrack for this moment. So that when, you know, the first time I hear Public Enemy, you know, I can literally remember the first time I heard Don't Believe the Hype, you know, on what would have been, you know, not even Hot 97 then. It was still, it was still on 99. And listening to these songs and going, wow, you know, this is the future for us, right? And being able to read about this stuff in places like The Village Voice, I think despite all this kind of Reagan-Bush moment, you know, that we saw largely, I think on a local level, we saw some incredible opportunities that were occurring on the ground.
So all of this stuff is perking away. You've got the computer job. You finally get laid off from that.
Yes.
You're reading the whole time. Decide to go back to school.
Well, the first thing I decided, you know, because I needed a job. And so I made a decision to become a New York City public school teacher. And at a time, you know, when it was very difficult to get public school teachers, they would allow people to work on these kind of provisional the provisional yeah. deals, right? You know, yeah. so you teach 2 years and promise that you'll do this, this, and that, you know, to get your normal certification. I went in the classroom in October of 1990, Walton High School in the Bronx. I got brought in at that period of time because the teacher, who was also a new teacher that was in the class before me, quit after 6 weeks because he couldn't deal with the class. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the feeling was they were throwing me into, you know, hell. And to this day, it remains the most rewarding teaching experience that I've ever had, because one of the things I understood intuitively with that first teaching experience was that if you're doing stuff in the classroom that is of interest of kids, you can engage them. And what was so extraordinary to me, you know, you'd have these kids who would walk the halls, and I would have these kids that would stop at the door of my class and just stand there and listen in. To the point that I was like, no, why don't y'all come into the classroom? And so that was when I recognized the magic of the classroom.
What were you doing in the classroom? Why?
You know, it was an English course. And so we're teaching kind of traditional things. But because, you know, I hadn't been taught traditional pedagogy, you know, my kind of spirit of improvisation played into my teaching style. And it was always about how do we connect with the students on the one hand, and then how do we, once we connect them, do we elevate the conversation? Right. And in 1990, we can elevate that conversation with Big Daddy Kane as easily as we can elevate that conversation with Langston Hughes. And as part of a generation, I think, that understood the capacity of using popular culture in that way. I remember there was an older teacher who was kind of, the mentor for young teachers. She retired the year that I taught at Walton, and she bequeathed all the teachers in the department different kinds of gifts. And her gift to me was an opportunity to teach a class on popular culture.
So you did it, and you were using that music in the classroom. Now, that was her gift to you. What was the rest of the school thinking about your approach?
I can't, you know, I'm not sure what the rest of the school was thinking about. I'd like to think that I made a connection with the students. Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that ultimately was important to me.
And the idea of popular culture, using it in the classroom and cultural studies, I think probably got a boost in 1991. This is the Rodney King incident, and it's making the headlines, but it's also so thoroughly entwined.
Because they're trying to figure out what this is about,
yeah.
right? And the common denominator that comes up over and over again is hip-hop. And suddenly mainstream culture is, well, you know, let's find the people who are talking about this, right? And suddenly you find all these Ivy League professors, you know, the Cornel West, bell hooks, you know, Michael Eric Dyson, you know, among that first generation, folks like Robin Kelly, you know, has been a great influence on me, Todd Boyd. I mean, all these folks who are suddenly on the Charlie Rose show and Nightline and all these television shows trying to give some context of what was happening. And for me, as I'm beginning graduate school, the thing that I remember is that, you know, they made for me the life of the mind sexy. Right. Yeah. I'm saying to myself, wow, this is something that I can do. I can go get a PhD and teach at a university and not have to be a specialist in 19th century African-American literature. Right. And I love 19th century African-American literature, but I didn't want to be limited to that as a scholar. Right. I joked that I think I was born interdisciplinary. You know, from the time I was 3 or 4 years old, I was always interested in bringing these different ideas together in conversation with each other. You know, so interdisciplinarity was just natural for me in that way.
Yeah, and you went to grad school, University of Buffalo?
University of Buffalo,
yeah.
And again, you know, in some ways, it's a crapshoot. I applied to one PhD program, and largely because my wife was the one who was making the money. You know, she was a counselor at SUNY Fredonia in the Educational Opportunity Program. And so I was not going to pursue a graduate program that took us away from that comfort zone. American Studies at the University of Buffalo had a great reputation. There were great scholars I wanted to work with there, like Charlie Kyle, the great ethnomusicologist, the first white guy to write, you know, for the Nation of Islam's Muhammad Speaks magazine. And so it was a perfect fit. And so I did American Studies, worked with Masani Alexis DeVoe, the great, you know, black lesbian, you know, feminist scholar. And it was an extraordinary experience. The thing I loved about the University of Buffalo is that if I didn't understand then that my value was not just what I was going to do into the academy, but how I could translate that to broader audiences. The fact that they had a prison program that was up and running, and they really pushed on us not to be overly professionalized within, you know, the discipline, I think that was so important for me at that particular point in time.
And is this when you were going back to not the ultimate roots, but roots like soul music and finding this stuff?
Absolutely.
That you had been more or less ignoring.
And you know, the thing that really helped me along, I did a radio program, WCVF in Fredonia, college radio, did for 5 years. I programmed a Sunday morning show called Soul Expressions. And they had this rich library of stuff, and I had liberated some stuff from my father and a bunch of other folks. And so I had 2 or 3 hours every Sunday morning, right, to really get deeply into, you know, the African-American musical tradition.
And here you are. We have a sound check from by a cassette, Soul Experience. Let's listen.
Good morning, and you are listening to 89. WCV Fredonia Soul Expressions. This music comes from the deepest expressions of the soul. Music for the spirit. Music for the people celebrating life, love, and good music on a Sunday morning. My name is Mark Anthony Neal. The time is 25 minutes to the hour. Up at 11 o'clock on this fall morning, the 22nd of October.
Oh, watch out, Eric Hodge. We've got a new morning show host, and you're at Soul Expressions.
Yeah, it was great because, you know, you had a lot of freedom. And I wanted to do a show because traditionally at the station, you know, they had something called All Jazz Sunday. And they would play jazz music. And it was a very popular format, but I wanted to break that up. So I wanted to be able to play some Hammond B3 stuff, but I also wanted to do some classic soul music and funk music. And by the time, the last 2 years of this show, I even brought in a talk process, you know, where I would interview folks. I interviewed Manning Marable. I interviewed Robin Kelly, Farrah Jasmine Griffin. And we do, you know, this kind of half hour segment of talking, you know, amidst all the music. I loved it. It was a great experience.
Mark Anthony Neal, my guest this hour, author of 5 books, including New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity, professor of Black Popular Culture at Duke, host of the web series Left of Black. Our conversation continues on The State of Things if you stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Mark Anthony Neal is my guest this hour, professor of Black Popular Culture at Duke, author of several books, his latest New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity. You're first on Marvin Gaye. Tell us about that work. What got you interested in that?
You know, I loved Marvin Gaye as a kid. Something my parents played a lot of, particularly my mother had an 8-track of Let's Get It On. You know, so that was a song that was, you know, just a part of my youthful soundtrack. By the time I got in grad school and got a chance and got really interested in black music vis-a-vis, you know, political implications, thinking about the late Eugene McDaniels, for example, you know, as somebody that I didn't know then, but I did know Marvin Gaye. And so, you know, I did this very interesting, my first published essay, scholarly published essay, is looking at Marvin Gaye's transition from what's going on to Let's Get It On, from what I call, you know, his transition from protest to climax. and arguing that, you know, even as his content becomes overly sexualized with Let's Get It On, he is still playing with these kind of political implications. Because in 1973, there really is no space in mainstream American culture for this absolute flourishing of black male sexuality, right? So this is a song, you know, this is an album in which so many of the songs about are about him giving pleasure to women, and you're hearing the women express that pleasure in the way that, you know, funk music did in the early 1970s, and trying to connect that to what was happening, you know, with, you know, politically when he does something like What's Going On.
When we think about these cultural studies, what's the value for all of us in understanding what you just described and thinking about popular culture in that way?
You know, my thing is that, you know, you can never think too deeply. You know, sometimes I get into discussion with students and other folks around the work that I do and some of my teaching, and the immediate response is, well, you know, aren't you thinking too deeply about this? And my response is always, you know, what's worse? You know, thinking too deeply or not thinking deep enough. And for me, it's about elevating the conversation, bringing to bear so many other things that give us a greater understanding. I mean, this is why art is art.
Yeah.
And it's not just about, you know, the human satisfaction of consuming art, but clearly there are political realities, you know, and economic and cultural realities that also are part of why we gravitate to music and popular culture the way that we do.
And I think the thing that people often miss in understanding why you would bother to plumb these depths of something that is popular culture is that whether or not the conclusion is correct is less important than the fact that I've taken you there. That's opened new pathways. It allows you to think about things in new ways and may spark an imaginative, a new idea that seems to me the important thing, whether or not Mark Anthony Neal's conclusion about, Marvin Gaye's trajectory.
Exactly, right.
Matters.
I mean, it's all, in some ways, it's about all of us being able to claim culture and to be able to put our stamp on how we read that culture and why it matters.
Yeah.
And that stuff never goes away. And so while I may not have any personal interest in listening to, say, Drake and Nicki Minaj, you know, there's some 25 or 20-year-old, you know, for which this matters, and it's important for them to have a space to be able to articulate that in the world.
And that said, that first essay of yours, you try to get it published, and that's exactly what
I can remember, you know, when it first got rejected, the response was that it was overwrought, overthought, over-intellectualized. And for me, you know, my response to that was like, that's actually what I want to hear, right? Because what that tells me is that they had no idea what I was talking about. And I was like, okay, that's fine. You know, I can work with that.
I'm on the right track. When you started publishing pieces about black music and culture, there was an established community of black intellectuals in elite institutions. Where did you feel you fit in with writers like Cornel West and Henry Louis Gates?
Yeah, I just looked at these folks and I would, you know, we all wanted to be like them, you know, whatever that meant. You know, ultimately, though, one of the people who had the most influence on me in that regard was someone like Robin Kelly, because his work never got away from that working class background that was who he was. In my mind, you know, I always wanted to be able to write stuff that wouldn't just make my parents proud, right? But that my parents would find value in. I mean, that ultimately what that my people would find, you know, folks I grew up with, yeah, my family, that they would find some value in that. You know, I also love the work of the late Manning Marable, right, who, of course, did this wonderful biography of Malcolm X that just recently came out, you know, to some controversy. You know, he made a decision very early in his career, in the spirit of Du Bois, is that he would do a syndicated column that he offered for free, you know, to the black press, you know, for decades. And for me, you know, that was, you know, when we think about public intellectuals, we always think about the cats who are on TV, right? And it's great to see Mark Eric Dyson or a Melissa Harris Perry on MSNBC and those kinds of things. But there are other ways in the world to be public intellectuals. And for me, it was important to be able to write for a broader public, right? So when I started writing back in 1999 for popmatters.com, you know, it just opened up a whole new world for me. But it also was a challenge, right? How do I take what I do as a scholar, you know, teaching in the classroom, writing for my colleagues, to write that in a way that's accessible, you know, for a broader audience, and not a stupid audience, right? Not an ignorant audience, but an audience that's not caught up in the jargon,
right,
of scholarly work, right, that is interested in being in the marketplace of ideas. And, you know, 11, 12 years after I started writing for Pop Matters, right, it still is a struggle. You know, that's why, you know, I give a lot of credit. I mentioned Mike Eric Dyson. I mean, I think his career trajectory has been incredible, because say what you want about his work, it is actually not that easy to be able to take high concepts and high ideas and present them for audience in a way that's accessible to us. I mean, that's an incredible amount of work.
Well, what's the hard part? Because that is the Holy Grail. Let's drop the conventions that have been the barrier to understanding, the convention, intellectual and scholarly conventions that are in the way, but maintain the intellectual rigor that gives them their grant.
I think one of the issues, and I know I struggled with this in graduate school, very often we let the jargon do the labor, right? So we throw out certain kind of terms. And my wife always jokes with me all the time about, you know, what she calls my favorite words, right? Discourse and diaspora, right? And you throw those words, you know, commodification, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you throw these kind of words out and the jargon does a certain kind of language that within the academy, right, everybody understands what that is, right? But you throw commodification out to, you know, everyday folks, and they're like, what exactly does that mean, right? And so part of it is trying to get from the comfort of the jargon, to get from the comfort of the theory, right, in order to just really tell a story in ways that's accessible to everyday folks.
How do you think black intellectualism is perceived once it leaves the classroom? You talked about this challenge of trying to make it accessible. What's the perception? And is it a challenge then, once you've got an image as somebody who's a public intellectual, can you go back? Does the academy say,
It depends on how people function. I mean, You know, until 6 months ago, there was an incredible, you know, Cornel West, for instance, had an incredible amount of goodwill, you know, amongst everyday folks. You know, that has changed somewhat in his criticisms of Barack Obama, right? Because there are many black folks that feel that he is contributing to, right, an environment, you know, right, that's already hostile to, you know, the first black president. And so I think it depends, right? I think when folks always feel that public intellectuals are doing things that are in the best interest of black communities. And the irony, of course, is that, you know, Noam Chomsky, you know, who is one of the great public intellectuals of it, in the United States now, doesn't have to live with that same kind of pressure, right, of speaking to a particular community or audience of folks that he has to live up to. So I think black public intellectuals have an added burden in that regard.
But you do cultivate an audience. I mean, he cultivates an audience among progressives. So then when he talks about a good war in the early 90s, everybody's going, what happened to Chomsky, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Does how about being a professor of black popular culture give you more latitude in the classroom, more freedom to experiment?
You know, I think if I wasn't just that, I would feel the need for that latitude, right? You know, I always see the classroom as really ultimately an experimental space, right, where you're pushing folks to think beyond their comfort zone, to be able to open their minds up to different concepts. I mean, one of the most exciting classes I teach regularly is a class called Sampling Soul, you know, which I co-teach with, you know, Riley's own Ninth Wonder. And it's such a different experience, right?
Because Durham's own.
Durham's own.
Go ahead.
but it's such a different experience, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, you have someone who is incredibly talented in terms of the technical aspects of what sampling is, right? But we're talking about this in the history of soul music. We're talking about intellectual property law. We're talking about concepts like appropriation and remixing. And so, you know, in that kind of space, it's really wide open in terms of what we can do.
Any of these studies that we take on, we'll talk about black popular music because I'm talking with you today, they're segmented in the sense that they are about a particular people at a particular time and a particular history. They teach us about the way we think and the way cultures move. So it has broad appeal, and yet they can be the very thing that creates and creates even thicker walls and deeper moats. Yeah. How do we get past that?
I think by being honest about the work. I think by being honest about the communities that we're writing about. I think one of the biggest challenges that black intellectuals have in general, whether or not they see themselves as public intellectuals or not, there's always this presumption that because you teach at a Duke or a Yale or a Harvard, that somehow you don't come from the South Bronx, right? That somehow you don't come from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, that somehow, you know, as someone who's viewed as being part of some sort of upper middle class elite, which, you know, if you're a working professor in America, you're not, you know, just being quite honest, you know, you're living paycheck to paycheck like a bunch of other folks. But there's always this presumption that we are classed in the way that disconnects us from everyday black communities. And the reality is that many of us, you know, are first generation folks who come from those very communities. Mm. And I think for me, I'm always reminded, I said this earlier, to make sure I do work that, you know, the folks that I grew up in the barbershop, Jesse's barbershop and Muriel's, you know, beauty parlor, you know, that I went to church with, that all of them would find value in the work that I
do. Have you ever tested that? Have you found people back in your neighborhood or family that has said?
You know, there's been, especially with Facebook now, and you find yourself reconnecting with folks. And I find that there is a great pride about my success, whatever that success is. And for me, that becomes important. You know, some of the things that I've done, you know, in terms of speaking engagement that have been so critically important to me is when I've spoken in prisons. And so I'm speaking in prisons and 50 and 60 year old black men, you know, who would have grown up the same generation of my father or the generation behind. And I start dropping, you know, these notions of the mighty clouds of joy and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, wow. Right. And in their mind, it's like, you know, we didn't know there were folks beyond these walls, right, who thought about these things the same way that you. And so that becomes, you know, that stuff is really important to me.
What brought you to Duke?
Well, I was at the University of Texas. I was there for all of 11 months. And essentially, I was recruited to Duke. North Carolina, you know, the Triangle region was the only place that my wife and I both agreed at the time that we wanted to move to. I always thought I'd end up at UNC. I didn't think I was a Duke cat. but it's been a good marriage so far, you know. So and we've loved Durham. You know, absolutely. You know, being able to have my afternoons at the BU Cafe, you know, mornings on the porch with no wireless at Parker and Otis, it's been very productive. But both my daughters are competitive swimmers, you know, at Yoder, the YMC, downtown YMCA. So it's been a wonderful space, you know, for us these last 6.5 years.
Do you think it's too early? We're talking about teaching pop culture, being in the moment and giving it intellectual weight. Can we start talking that way now about Twitter, about social media? Is it too soon?
No, I don't think it's too soon. I mean, we just see the movement all the time, and right, this ability to be able to reach thousands of people at any time. You know, I have 6,500 followers on Twitter, you know, so potentially, you know, besides those 6,500, whoever they're connected to, I mean, anything that I want to say can reach out to these folks. You know, clearly there's, with any new technology there, folks are going to use it very frivolously, right? That's just a reality. But there are folks who have been able to use it in ways when we look to see what happened in, you know, Tahrir Square earlier this year, what was happening in Madison, Wisconsin. Shout out to someone like Jasiri X, you know, in Pittsburgh, who's been able to use social media and YouTube to talk about political realities in places like Pittsburgh that normally would not get covered in the mainstream press. I mean, it is about this DIY ethic, right? Us being able to take control of the media.
But the idea that we're going to give it some deep intellectual theory or build a theory around it while it's happening before our eyes. And again, the question is, well, have we given it enough time? And we talked about this question. Well, we don't need the right answer. It doesn't have to be the right theory. It just takes us somewhere. Yet we're still living in a world where we're kind of ancient in that way, aren't we? I mean, in the way we receive information. So we sit down, we hear a theory. There's so many of us who think, well, I've heard the theory, that's the truth. And that's part of our problem, isn't it? We take the thing as the truth instead of being playful about it.
I'm really ambivalent about it because I have this thing about, you know, there's so much pressure in our culture now to think quickly about things. Everything is tied to a news cycle. You know, so there are things that you can't talk about. Right, unless it's an anniversary, anniversary somewhere, you never talk about these things. Whereas, you know, 40 years ago, you know, you could have Village Voice is another example where you could just write about ideas for the sake of writing about ideas. And for me, it's trying to find a way to balance that, right? To be able to have a space where you can just solely live in a world of ideas, but also being able to bring your expertise and your passion to intervene in issues as they're occurring. One of the great things for me about Twitter is that, you know, what I do most of the time on Twitter is teach. Things happen, and part of my job on Twitter is to bring a historical context to this stuff and why it happens. And because Twitter tends to be a younger audience, right, there's an audience that's open there for broadening their conversation of what exactly is happening at this point.
And you've got a webcast, Left to Black.
Left to Black, which has been extraordinary, you know, working with the John Hope Franklin Center with Catherine Angst, you know, who's the videographer. And Jason Doty, who runs the John Hope Franklin Center. It's this opportunity, again, to think very deeply, but in ways that are recognizable to this generation of social media.
Well, you call it a contrarian view of blackness. Why?
Because I'd like to think that what we do on Left to Black is not the blackness that you're going to get on BET or TV1 or Fox or MSNBC or CNN, right? Not going to be the standard talking heads, right? We're going to talk to folks who are doing incredible things artistically, intellectually, who are never going to get the chance, you know, save maybe an opportunity on NPR. And so the idea that we do this show and to keep it honest and keep the conversation honest and informative, at the same time, you know, when we broadcast the shows on Mondays, it's the whole tweeting of the show also to make it a kind of social media experience. We had an extraordinary experience doing this for the first year.
Mark, always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, professor of Black popular culture in the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, author of New Black Man, which you can has a blog spot at newblackman.blogspot.com, and the web series is Left to Black, found at lefttoblack.tumblr.com. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.